This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today we have Jerry Braun, who is going to be talking about an analysis he did of non-energy benefits of local resource development. Jerry, why don't you go ahead and tell us what you found.
Okay, thanks, Sierra. Actually, I've been looking forward to this conversation because, this is a topic that doesn't get much attention by economists and and people who I would hope would be looking at it. I've had occasion to do some, gather some data for our county and crunch some numbers because we have a community choice program, and one of the goals of the community choice program is to facilitate local resource development, and there are some conflicts involved in that to the extent that the business model for community choice is really really designed to import electricity into the area and have the the grid operator basically deliver it and bill people for it and so forth. So the business model doesn't necessarily considers the internal economics for the community choice agency, but not the potential benefits to the local economies that it serves. And so I was interested in seeing if there are benefits and to what extent they strengthen the local economy served in our case by the in Yolo County by Valley Clean Energy, the community choice provider. So the questions though that I want to put on the table here and hopefully address and then discuss, what are the benefits, number one? Number two, do cities and counties, whether they're served by community choice or not, have an economic interest in using more energy that's produced locally and importing less from regional supply grids? Number three, is there a need for better tools to evaluate the benefits in a way that trained economists would consider valid? And finally, how can local governments capture the benefits in collaboration with incumbent energy providers, and whether they're community choice providers or not? So those are the questions. And then just to kind of motivate it, one of the things that is happening across the country is solar deployment, and a lot of it is basically behind the meter, and it's growing. And in states where there are high electricity prices, it's really actually moving the needle in terms of demand for electricity that's produced by burning fuels. The states where that's happening, where it's noticeable, are California and Hawaii. Just to kind of give you a little kind of profile of our county, our electricity usage is around 1,750 gigawatt hours per year. We're a county of about 200,000 people. Our natural gas use, and these statistics probably don't mean a whole lot, but we use also 59 million therms per year of natural gas. And we also produce a lot of our electricity, but some of our electricity is produced locally, and the percentages we actually get close to 50% of our electricity from renewable sources, about 9% of our renewable electricity is produced on site. About 16% is produced in local projects, and then about 21% is imported by our community choice program and by the grid owner, PG&E. And about half of our emissions, a little bit more than half from electricity, and a little bit less than half from natural gas. So that gives you an idea of our size and scope. It's perhaps an interesting case study, because our county is a good mix of residential, light commercial, industrial, and agricultural energy usage. So our renewable electricity supply, 21% comes from on-site solar, 34% from projects in the service area that are where electricity is purchased, and then about 36% is imported by our community choice agency. About 10% is imported by the grid operator, and that the total is about 45% of our total electricity consumption in the county. So that's the background. Now, I looked at four different areas of benefits, and it just coincidentally, I think, turned out that they were all had about the same general ballpark impact. First of all, avoiding electricity imports by having electricity produced, on homes and businesses is in the county roughly $23 million worth of annual production, and it's increasing. Another factor that is a little bit subtle is that with solar costs having come down so much and grid electricity prices increasing, at least in our part of California, the cost to the consumer of solar electricity is about 50% less than the cost of the average cost of grid electricity. And on the non-energy side, there's also because of the projects and the systems being installed, there's job creation, direct, indirect, and induced, so to speak, and that also has an estimated benefit to the county that you can quantify that, and it's in the tens of millions of dollars, actually more than $50 million from all of the projects, basically. And then another non-energy benefit is the fact that we have a cap and trade program for greenhouse emissions in California. So depending on what the value that program assigns to GHG emissions, we're avoiding some of them in the county, and therefore not paying for the carbon content of some of the energy that we use. So those are four categories of energy and non-energy benefits, and then I guess to kind of wrap up a little bit, going back to the question, is local energy production strengthening our county? And it does appear that local economies can benefit, especially in areas where imported energy is relatively expensive, and there's a collateral benefit of cleaner and more resilient local energy infrastructure and service. So we've tapped a modest portion of this economic, you know, this potential economic benefit in our county. And in the case of on-site solar, it's happened relatively quickly. What will be needed in the future, I think, is closer collaboration between our local governments in the county and local energy service providers, including Valley Clean Energy and PG&E, to accelerate and maximize the benefits, and also, address all the other issues, siting, safety, consumer protection, and so forth. So I think it would be a good idea to have to prepare some sort of integrated resource plan. The utilities do that. They do prepare integrated resource plans, both the Community Choice Agency and PG&E. But the plans don't focus at all on local resource development. So we need a plan for local, an integrated resource plan for local resources as well. So finally, going back to the questions, what are the local economic benefits? They're multiple. From job creation to avoiding, basically taxes or surcharges for carbon creation or for greenhouse gas creation. Cities and counties do appear to have an economic interest in using more energy that's produced locally and importing less from regional grids. The question is whether, is there a need for better tools to evaluate these benefits? And I think my interest is whether there is a sub school of economics that deals with local economies that would, be able to do a better job of answering this question than I can. And finally, there is a question of how can local governments collaborate with incumbent energy providers to strengthen local economies. And I don't think that's getting a whole lot of attention yet, but hopefully it will. So that's my introduction, and I'm looking forward to a good discussion.
All right. Thanks, Jerry. Does anybody have any comments about that? Any thoughts or additions?
This is Craig Lewis. Jerry, great discussion here, and thanks for putting your slides together. My comment and question to you is that I think that local really needs to be clearly defined, and it needs to be defined as being interconnected to the distribution grid. And the reason for that is when you're on the distribution grid, you are actually local. You are close to where people live and work because nobody gets served by a transmission voltage level line. And in addition, it's very important to distinguish between the distribution grid, which is local, and the transmission grid, which is not. And the reasons for that are that they are completely regulated differently. They are monetized differently. For example, the regulation for the distribution grid is the CPUC here in California. It's California Public Utilities Commission. The regulation for the transmission grid is CAISO and FERC. And from an economic monetization standpoint, the distribution grid is included in the general rate case, and it's calculated locally, if you will, and the transmission economics and monetization are basically governed by FERC and the FERC, you know, guaranteed return on equity for transmission is far higher than what the states allow for distribution grid investments. So there's a real significant distinction between, you know, local distribution grids and you know, remote transmission grids.
And just thank you, Craig. That's I appreciate that comment. One thing I should say is that we tend to forget that there are other energy distribution grids, including natural gas. And I think that I personally think that it's important for collaboration and consideration to be given to, you know, those sources of, the fuel sources coming into the local area, as well as the electricity being brought into the local area or produced in the local area, because in the longer term, we probably do need both fuel, hopefully low or zero carbon fuels, as well as low and zero carbon electricity for local use.
Hi, Jerry. This is Larissa. Enjoyed your presentation as always. And I guess, you know, I have two questions. I'd have to say even burning as to one. As you may recall, you know, I came to meet you when the CEC, remember, had that RESCO, Renewable Energy Secure Communities Initiative. Okay? What is that? Date back to what? 2000, maybe 9?
2008 or 9, yeah.
Right. And that was supposed to be a context for collaboration between local government and utilities, and with a view to, you know, prompting local energy production. And in fact, you know, the RESCO was significant from the standpoint of calling upon communities to either start plans or implement plans that they have in place, but in order to develop multiple sources of local energy. And that was back when. So my first question has to do with barriers. Here we are, you know, 2019, okay? If it was going to happen anywhere, you would think it would have happened in California. What has not evolved? Why hasn't this gone in the direction of greater collaboration and more recognition and accounting for the value of local energy production, local load management, etc.? So that's my first. And you think also California would have some kind of roadmap given what happened in the past over significant time and continues to have beneficial impacts with respect to energy efficiency. And energy efficiency is moving to, I think, the deadlines for the big, bold, you know, zero, you know, net energy targets. And you would think, okay, much remains to be done that you've brought out, but still there's just such a evidentiary track record about the need to take into account these local impacts, to recognize their benefits and seek to monetize them. So that's one question. And then the second one goes to, you raise the need on the integrated resource planning. Have you been following, you know, NARUC now, and teeing off of what California has been doing, wants to integrate distributed resource planning into integrated planning and end-to-end, which includes not only from generation but all the way down to the consumer programs. And I think more of us need to input into this process to make sure it lifts off the ground. But this is a big overarching initiative now of NARUC and it wants to, you know, do this type of integration across all of the different, you know, segments of the electricity value chain. So first is the barriers, and, well, what are the lessons learned in California? Because this, I guess, as someone that has also done a lot of work in California, this still amazes me, and that's why I'd like to hear your reactions on that. And then, two, the efforts of NARUC and how they can parlay into hopefully nurturing this kind of collaboration that needs to take place between the local government and utilities.
Oh, great. Thank you, Larissa. Great questions. And I, you know, you might expect that, yeah, I have looked back on the RESCO program, and, you know, and particularly one of the things that we omitted to do, we did require, in terms of the grant criteria, we required utility participation, and of course, also local government participation in the lead on the projects. What we didn't require, and should have, would be that the utilities not simply sit at the table and observe, but have an active role in the projects. And I think that was a mistake, and it's certainly a correctable mistake, because the program, actually, without the same name, is actually continuing, and that would be the one thing that I would say is a kind of a key program design.
And is this, by the way, the Advanced Energy Communities now? Is that what you're speaking of?
And so the requirement really should be that that the both sides need to have a defined role in the projects, and that I think that's something that could be required.
Something more by way of a kind of a framework context that sort of provides some structure and guidance to the way in which they play together?
Sure, and I'm just brainstorming that, you know, in a sense, because I'm not involved in that anymore. But I do think that if it were going back to my comment about the need for integrated local resource plans, if in fact that were one of the categories that the grants are available to support, that would be good. But it would also be good, you know, in terms of follow-on grants or follow-on support, that you would be rewarded for having done that and doing it as a partnership or as a collaboration between the grid owners and local government. That would I think that would be a way of getting the cart behind the horse in a sense, and doing the planning scoping things out, and some communities have done that without being required to do it. I know we did it for Davis, but an integrated analysis anyway. It didn't result in a plan per se. But I think there's a way of saying, you know, there is a process here, and there are steps that need to be taken in order. And you start by looking, and this is kind of what I presented in this little discussion. You start by taking inventory of what's really happening and what the trends are and what how much of your energy you're getting from where and things like that. All, you know, where are you right now? And then build a plan based on what seems to be feasible, what seems to be moving, and then worry about getting other things moving later on. So going to the NARUC efforts, I do think that that there is a great potential for, for state regulators to, think beyond simply, their basic economic regulation function. If states have policies to have utilities and local governments engage, certainly the state regulators can provide frameworks for that and rewards for that as well. I haven't given that a lot of thought, so that may not be a complete
answer.
Well,
what I was, just to clarify, because, I mean, California has been the lead in terms of distribution resource planning. And if you look at the framework, you see, to me, it's a model. It's a true model in terms of the elements. Whatever parties say, different circumstances in California, et cetera, the elements that have been taken up in all of that work, I think, provide excellent guidance for the rest of the country. And the relevance here is you're looking at here monitoring, tracking in a very consistent, methodical way, as one element, not just the load growth, but the DIR growth and the patterns and the scenarios. And in fact, this is supposed to be underpinning, I have not followed it lately, but eventually the development of economic development zones, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all going to, well, where can we get the biggest bang for the buck, and how can the utilities do the necessary mapping, the hosting capacity, evaluations, and also the net locational benefit analyses. But California, unlike the rest of the country, is developing uniform, verifiable methods that all of the utilities are supposed to be using, okay? You have uniform methods and then apply to the varying circumstances. And to me, we need that kind of consistent uniform methodology, but what you're describing can feed into the continuing evolution of this, distribution resources planning, and then how it is integrated into the integrated resources planning of the utility at all of the, electricity segments levels.
Yeah, one thing I probably should say, and I probably should have said, is that what I'm seeing is that the local resource development is moving forward on pathways that are available. Other pathways are blocked because of the fact that the smart grid, smart local grids that utilities have been talking about for three decades are not happening. And in order to accommodate, for example, on the electricity side, local production in an economically optimum way for the community, there needs to be a way of operating the distribution system so that it doesn't, you're not stuck with your only option is to add capacity, upgrade transformers, upgrade, resize wires, do a huge amount of retrofit on the distribution system. Rather, you have the ability to, regulate the flow of electricity both ways on the distribution system rather than just one way. And
the reason why they're doing the distribution resource planning, this is supposed to create alternatives to the, top-down centralized paradigm strategies and offer up, in fact, non-wires alternatives. But you need methodologies to be able to identify the areas that, due to constraints on the grid, other factors, reflect value from the standpoint of siting distributed resources, the value that they can bring in terms of to the grid. But the type of methodology is looking at, not just from the load, but also tracking the patterns with respect to DIR growth. And I mean, if you, it's moving in the direction of changing the utility regulatory paradigm to take these resources into account. And if they provide more cost-effective solutions, I mean, the utility operates in the public interest. Shouldn't those be the ones then selected, indifferent to ownership, business model, et cetera?
This is Lori.
Well, yeah.
I think Larissa, you know, hit it right on the head. The you know, the issue is really one of cost versus value, and our regulatory system is set up to only look at costs and not you know, not acknowledge value. And you know, we see that in the New York Rev, where they're trying to put a value on, you know, what are the non-market traded benefits, you know, that we don't see. You know, we can't put a price tag.
Non-market traded yet.
Exactly. But until you can see a price in a market, you know, it's
right.
Very difficult for regular. It's very difficult for people to agree on what that value is. You
but
know?
See, that's the important of the California. California is really insisting on uniform, consistent, verifiable methods.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes to what you brought up, Jerry, about new tools and methods. Unless you have them, you're not going to have recognition of the benefits. You're not going to have the means to quantify, monetize those benefits, and compare them to the traditional strategies.
But there's been a lot of work done in California on exactly this issue. I just think there's not been really agreement on how to monetize those values.
Lori, why don't you give everybody an idea of what you do? I don't think they know what's your job.
Okay, so I'm an economist and have some of the work that I've done in California. I mean, I've worked on the RESCO. I do a lot of work with the University of California at Irvine. They've got an advanced power and energy program that's a bunch of super bright engineers who 10 years ago didn't know anything about economics. So I'm not an adjunct, but I'm kind of their, you know, they put me in on projects that have an economics component. But prior to getting involved with them, I did, it became known as the, infamously in some cases, Craig can speak to that, the PV waterfall. And it was a very early effort prior to the CSI, kind of in support of the CSI, looking at, you know, so what are all the values that, in that case, rooftop solar brings to the table, and what's are the values that it does bring. And I can share I'll share that with Sierra after this call, kind of what that looked like. And in that case, we sliced all the different values and put a range of values on each slice. You know, so for instance, you know, what was the avoided natural gas cost if you didn't have to, you know, run a natural gas plant? And by really slicing the values into really as small as you could make them, a policymaker looked at the waterfall and said, well, I don't think this slice has any value. They could make that slice zero without impacting, you know, all the other slices. But the question really is, you know, how, and, you know, I've done subsequent work on, you know, what's the value of stationary fuel cells, solar hot water, large-scale solar thermal. But the question is always, you know, without a price in a market, you know, you've got all the invested interests that are going to argue all day, well, you know, that can't possibly be that, you know, value. We think it's, you know, higher or lower depending on what their interests are. So that's, I think you're, you know, Marisa, absolutely right. It's, you know, how do we get agreement on the valuation of the benefits, and then how do you put those in rates? And, you know, New York is trying to do that in the Rev, but it's very difficult because you can't, you know, see it in a market.
This is David Kay. I can jump in at this point. I went to graduate school about 40 years ago trying to figure out how to answer the questions that were just posed. And I just wanted to point out that the previous speaker agree with everything that she just said, and draw the attention to the importance of frameworks. So somebody very early on talked about geographies that are important. There's also conceptual frameworks that are important. And previous speaker was talking in what I would call cost-benefit kind of thinking about, you know, how do you value non-market goods, what are the benefits, and how do you compare the cost of that, which I think is a very, very important framework. I just want to draw the distinction between that and what I'm looking at here in Jerry's chart or set of PowerPoints, which you referred to, the idea of direct, indirect, and induced job creation kinds of numbers. Those are like different kinds of numbers, at least from an economist's perspective, because they have to do not with values so as much as other kinds of measurable impacts, to use that kind of terminology, on the local economy. So, you know, how much value does a job have? Well, there's different ways of thinking about that, but in this framework, it's like how many jobs are created at what salaries. And I see some of those kinds of estimates here, but I'm wondering, Jerry, if you could clarify what your questions kind of were about that kind of economic framework and the kinds of numbers you're trying to put up there, because those kinds of numbers under direct, indirect, and induced job creation are what I would call, you asked, like, is there an analytic framework or are there economists to do that? They're generally, that's kind of bread and butter for what I would call regional economists. Mm-hmm. And then the avoided embedded carbon cost kind of idea, that's much more like environmental or resource economics, or maybe in a regulatory framework, there's another name for that, but it's kind of conceptually different kind of measure.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that's very helpful, David, because that's getting at the, you know, my concern about how valid are some of these, ideas of value that I've put forward. From a, you know, from an economist's perspective, I should mention that the there was a nice piece of work done. I think it was reported by the Center for Climate Protection and it was basically an analysis of San Jose's. What if there were a community choice program in San Jose, and what if the it succeeded in creating, you know, local renewable projects, and so there was an analysis of all the basically of job creation, and what was interesting to me, or what has been interesting to me, was. That sounds like that's a kind of settled approach to evaluating economic benefits, but there are other benefits, including simply having less dollars flowing out of a local community for energy and being able to spend less to create the energy. Locally, you know, those are the kinds of things that I'm not that comfortable, you know, with. How do you get at that in a valid economic analysis?
Well, I would say there's always estimates. There's things you can measure and things you can estimate, and the types of things you're talking about are all the ones you just mentioned are pretty squarely within the routine things that, again, what I would call regional economists think about, looking at economic impacts of different kinds of economic activities on local and regional economies. The other kinds of things that are, they're big questions, like how much is it worth to society as a whole to do activity X versus activity Y, or how much is clean air worth? You know, those kinds mm-hmm. of things that are in the other category of economic impacts that I think are more like avoided embedded carbon cost impacts.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the main differences between those things is are there actually dollars and jobs moving around in the local economy or not? Like when you think about the value of clean air, there are many, many benefits that you can estimate of that don't actually involve dollar transactions in the economy.
Yeah.
I'll just add this. You know, looking across what different states are doing and all, I think, you know, David, what you brought out is a good point, and to combine it also with Lori and then things I was discussing about what's happening in California itself. But, I mean, in terms of you're looking at here the societal benefits, now there's a big contention across the country as to changes in the utility regulatory paradigm as to whether those benefits will be integrated into a new utility paradigm. Now, New York, of course, has gone with a societal benefit test, but that had huge, wave effects, and I just participated in this D.C. Metis proceeding, and just to mention what New York Rev had done there, you know, just, you should see, rocked the opponents in the D.C. Metis proceeding, okay? But it's what will be recognized and where, so those societal benefits, big contention. However, you know, more directly, you know, adding to the conversation here, more directly, nonetheless, all utilities need to address the impacts of what goes on locally, both in terms of load management, you know, in terms of load demand management, as well as local production. And that's why I brought out the California methodologies. They will be beneficial in that regard. And these are the kind of impacts, I mean, in terms of utility forecasting, utility planning, that the utility must take into account. And also the value of these resources in terms of alleviating constraints that the utility is experiencing, and also to address the impacts in changing the generation mix. I mean, moving to, you know, 50%, 100% renewable energy, the impacts on a system that is designed to use fossil are going to be clear, and you have to be in a position to evaluate and determine then, you know, what your solutions are going to be, how you make use of these resources for flexibility. So in terms of economics, there are categories, whatever the contention on the societal benefits, and that's going to be a real Promethean battle in so many jurisdictions across the United States. Nonetheless, in terms of these impacts on the grid, that's where I think I'm frustrated with the regulatory lag. I mean, I feel these utilities that operate in the public interest owe it to the public to begin doing these analyses and doing them in consistent ways. And these economic methodologies are important underpinnings then to filter into the market and in terms of then the valuation processes, the pricing. You need these methodologies. And certainly, you know, on these matters and resiliency. That's a tough one, but these are the areas that I'm getting very discouraged that things are not moving fast enough. And, you know, what you brought out has those impacts on the grid, and the impacts are increasing exponentially, but we're not getting the kind of analyses and methodologies developed. And in fact, if this DC Metis is any indication of what's going on in a prevalent matter, these utilities would like to fragmentize this. I mean, you don't have, in terms of our legacy system, we don't have 50 different methodologies in these rate-making cases. there are some very standard accounting methodologies. And what irks me is, like, PEPCO wants to have its own methodology for evaluating the impacts of here, local energy production, you know, the distributed generation, the whole expanse of the DER, demand side. They want to have their own methodology. I mean, how can you have your own methodology? We need some harmonization here across the United States in terms of how to evaluate these impacts, their net benefits, and so we'll be in a better position to be able to compare the traditional strategies versus the new ones that are emerging.
So I hear what you're saying, and I'm not deeply into sort of the level of nitty-gritty detail about how I'm an academic, essentially, so I don't have the sense of compelling one way or the other about sort of what happens around the country the way you all do. But I would just say that there are going to be, you know, ultimately I would say that.
Well, can I put it one way to you?
Let me finish.
Sure.
The point I want to make is that within the sort of range of possible benefits and costs that could be quantified, some of them you're going to get like 50 different economists and you're going to get one kind of result pretty close, and some other ones you're going to get 50 different results. So the point I'm trying to make is, what, you know, the point of standardization is there's going to have to be some hard judgments made that isn't going to make everybody happy about how to do those costs, and they will be contestable in sort of from a sort of abstract perspective. It's not an accounting problem per se. There's a lot of choices that have to be made, and how do you approach, and what's the right measure for these things, and there will be debate about it. And there should be.
Well,
because what, not the right answer.
Two clarifications real quickly. One, agree first that you have to see different categories and what you're looking at in terms of benefits, and I think you brought that out well. But I'm saying there's a certain category that cannot be avoided, really, by utilities, given policy directives and the now, I think, definitive move toward increasing renewable energy in the generation mix. And that brings with it, particularly as to the intermittent renewables, that brings new characteristics, I mean, in terms of these resources and their impact, their very impact on the stability of the grid. So you, whether academic or otherwise, you do pay for electricity, and so that impact could hit you as an individual in terms of greater instability if the utility is not going to address these impacts that are becoming bigger and bigger as you get the penetration of renewable energy, intermittent renewable energy, into the marketplace. So number one, there is a compelling need because you can look to Germany as an illustration and the impact on the German grid in terms of the feed-in tariffs and what happened there. And they had to stop coal and address it. But the ironic thing is because they did not plan, they did not look at the different characteristics of renewable energy versus a system that's designed for fossil fuel. Initially, before they, you know, evolved different approaches, methodologies, they actually had to use coal. So you can imagine, and when the statistics came out, of how using coal to address the instability created by the feed-in tariff, I mean, that undermined, to say the least, the achievement of the renewable energy objectives. So that is compelling. But then also, you know, here, I mean, you know, we're so used to the accounting systems and the methodologies used under the current regime that I think they become subconscious. And whether contentious or not, if this is growing and we're moving to greater and greater, you know, mixes of renewable energy in our generation sources, we have to evolve new accounting systems, whether contentious or not. And when we look at what we have, I mean, it reflects the need. You know, in these rate-making cases, you can't have 50 different accounting approaches. And if we had, we wouldn't be where we are today. So we have to look at what we've used in the past and see the need to now bring in the new resources.
Okay, I'd like to cut in here for a second and see if there's anything anybody else who has not had a chance to speak has any comments about this.
I'll just chime in. This is Craig Lewis again, and I'm sorry I've been a little intermittent, but I did hear Lori's comment about the waterfall analysis, and yes, I was one of the ones who go way back to that day, and I thought that analysis was excellent and very pertinent to all the way, you know, to the current day and beyond. But I do want to just react here a little bit to what Larissa was just saying. Larissa was just saying is that you know, the Germans had to turn on coal because not because of renewables in any form or fashion. It's because they shut down a whole bunch of their nuclear plants, right? That was decided after Fukushima. So that was the cause for coal to come on. It's been a whole bunch of fear, uncertainty, and doubt that people have been spreading.
And the feed-in tariff. They had to use coal. Picture. But they had to go to coal for the feed-in tariff.
Okay, guys. Let's table that conversation for now. I know it's important to both of you. So let's talk about that.
I will just say one other thing.
Yeah.
One other thing that Germany is really important point in Germany. Germany has a electric grid that is far more reliable. Their reliability metrics run circles around the United States reliability metrics for their electric grid. So even though they have way more renewables embedded into their electricity grid, their reliability metrics are 10 times better. So, you know, if anybody's worried about resilience, which I think Larissa, you know, said we need to worry more about resilience, the Germans are running circles around the U.S. electric grids.
Okay, we have a few other people here on the call who have not spoken. Jeff Chinsky or Chris Carrick, any of you have any comments? Karen? Michelle?
Well, I don't have any specific comments. We're having a very interesting discussion, and I think it kind of points to some of the fundamental battles that, you know, we're all facing in this thing, and the fact that every state and in some cases regions within the state are doing things differently really just makes it difficult to come up with a unified strategy, I guess, is maybe the simple way of putting it.
Okay, Chris, Carrick, do you have any comments?
Well, some folks may know that I've been pretty involved with the value of distributed energy resources proceeding here in New York, and was very interested in a report that ICF produced in May of this year for the Department of Energy, which was sort of a meta-analysis of different state cost-benefit studies related to net metering and distributed solar. And I encourage everyone to first look at that report, and there's a lot of great references to those state reports in there as well. But they distinguish between, you know, the various cost-effectiveness tests that are used by utilities, ranging from the most narrow participant costs through rate impact measure tests, through total resource cost tests, which is what traditionally has been used here in New York, all the way to the most broad, which is the societal cost test. And I would argue that that's clearly where we need to go. And unfortunately, it seems to be a state-by-state fight to push the public service commissions or public utility commissions in that direction, but it's the only way that I can see to try to account not only for all of the environmental benefits, but all of the economic benefits of not only distributed or renewable sources, but local resources. There's a reference in this report to a study done by the National Efficiency Screening Project. I guess it's a 2017 report called the National Standard Practice Manual, which I think makes some recommendations along these lines. And I'm wondering if anyone on the call is familiar with that work or has any comment about that.
I'm not familiar with that one, but California has. That's why I do say, I mean, each of these have got people-based utility commissions, and the utilities have a very vast interest in seeing this.
Breaking up your bad here, Karen. Hear me?
You're breaking up a little bit.
Yeah, you're breaking up very badly. I can hardly hear what you're saying. Is this Karen? Or Lori?
That was Lori, but you're breaking up I pretty bad at it.
Yeah, can't hear.
Sierra, your connection is bad too. I wonder if it's just the line in general.
Oh, or is everybody else having a problem as well right now?
Yeah,
I can hear you just fine. I can hear you, Sierra. I think that was Lori talking. That was breaking up a lot.
Right. Okay.
You know, I just want to put in one point, but see, that's the value of what New York is doing. At least it's lifting it to the surface, which really is laudatory on New York's part. No matter how contentious, they're not bearing the matter. They're coming out with the studies. And to me, at a minimum, I think that's what should be percolating across the United States, not what happened in the D.C. METSIS process.
Well, I would just add we have a long way to go, because I've had conversations with John Rhodes, the chair of the commission, about some of these issues, and he was unaware. He actually made the argument that no one has studied the economic development benefits of DER, when it's clearly shown in this ICF report that the state of Arkansas did a study that found the value of local economic development to be about $33 a megawatt hour. And the state of Louisiana also did a study using NREL's JEDI model, which speaks to some of the issues David Kay was talking about, which differentiated direct, indirect, and induced economic development benefits. So I guess my point is, you know, we know or we should know how to do this. The question is not, you know, technical. The question is political.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, maybe it needs greater leadership at the NARUC level. And they seem to be skirting this. I have not in the kind of leadership on this particular matter that I think is warranted, even given our micro discussion.
I would just add also, I think this is really important because the scale of sort of who's the audience for this is going to vary. And in the work I've done mostly with local economic development kinds of questions, the idea of indirect and induced money flows and job creation, as well as tax-based questions, are much more salient than the kind of big social benefits. Now, that may or may not be relevant in a particular kind of discussion, like at the state level about REV or whatever. But I just would caution us all to think about is the need to think about who's reading this and how they're thinking about it being very different at different levels of decision-making and efforts to influence folks.
That is such a huge issue, David, because the people who would get involved in the kind of local, you know, integrated resource planning or whatever you call it that we were talking about earlier are the local, you know, elected officials and economic development folks who care about those things. But that's a completely separate world from the Public Service Commission. And, you know, municipal local officials rarely get involved in commission-level matters. So there's a wide gap there that needs to be bridged.
You know, for all of these metrics, getting it to a very simple construct is super important so everybody can wrap their arms around it and come to agreement. I really liked what the gentleman from New York said about Arkansas came up with a $33 per megawatt hour. I'd love to see that report. And then mentioned that Alabama and some other places had come up with similar analyses, but didn't say the metric. But $33 per megawatt hour is so easy to calculate. It's such a tangible figure, and anybody anybody who's made it through algebra and math can do the calculation. So I would, that's exactly the type of metric, of easy standardized metric that we need to be promoting out there. And I'd love to see what Arkansas, you know, how they did their analysis and most importantly, right, to see that kind of $33 per megawatt hour construct, super, super useful for that to be as simple as that is.
I'm going to check with Catherine Johnson on that. She works with Arkansas and maybe haven't been involved in that particular report. So we're out of time, guys. Chris, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that are going on in New York, if you have some time to do that. And also, just a reminder that on Thursday, Larissa Dobriansky is going to be discussing advanced microgrids at 1 o'clock on Eastern time, so it's a little bit different time than it was today. But I hope all of you can attend that and have a conversation around that. It sounds like it could be very important and interesting. So hope to see you all next time. We have a webinar coming up at the end of the month in July that Samuel Golding will be putting on, and he has yet to exactly tell me what it's going to be about, but I know Samuel well enough to know it will be extremely interesting, whatever it is. So hope to see you next time, and please come on Thursday.
Goodbye, Mom.
Thanks, everybody.